content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 5th, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. The cover this week shows a roller coaster at an amusement park, and in the front cart of the roller coaster is Donald Trump with his hands up in the air over his head, his tie flying, and he's got a great big grin on his face. Cart next to him is Uncle Sam holding on to the bar and holding on to his hat. The seat behind them has Nancy Pelosi with a startled look, holding on to what looks like an airplane barf bag. And then at the very back, hanging on to the edge of the seat with his feet flying out, is Paul Ryan. And the title says, Wild Ride. Have Trump's first 100 days been a success or a failure? And with that, we'll go to the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's flurry of major proposals. What happened? President Donald Trump marked the final week of his first 100 days in office with a whirlwind of activity designed to pile up accomplishments, unveiling an ambitious tax reform proposal, and signing a flurry of executive orders. Trump imposed a tariff on softwood lumber imports from Canada, signed executive orders to lift offshore drilling regulations, and rescind national monument designations, and was reportedly close to announcing that he would withdraw the U.S. from NAFTA. In his dramatic overhaul of the tax code, the president proposed slashing the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%, a rate that would also apply to small businesses that file their returns under the individual tax code. The plan would also reduce the number of individual income tax brackets from 7 to 3, 10%, 25%, and 35%, and roughly double the standard deduction for individuals, essentially eliminating taxes on the first $24,000 of a couple's earnings. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin called it the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country. The massive reduction in revenues from all the cuts, however, would add more than $3 trillion to the deficit over 10 years. Mnuchin said that stimulating economic growth, the cuts would mostly pay for themselves. In Congress, lawmakers were trying to agree on a budget deal in order to prevent a government shutdown as the week went to press. Trump demanded last week that the appropriations bill include $1.4 billion for his proposed wall along the Mexican border, offering Democrats money for Obamacare subsidies in exchange. But when Democrats refused, insisting they would block any bill that funded the border wall, Trump backed down. Republicans were also taking another shot at repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. The conservative House Freedom Caucus, which helped scuttle the ill-fated American Health Care Act in March, gave its blessing this week to an amendment to the bill that would allow states to opt out of key Obamacare rules, including a requirement that insurers cover pre-existing conditions. The focus will now shift to moderate Republican lawmakers who fear a constituent backlash over cuts in subsidies and protections. What the editorial said, President Trump is right to aim for a tax system with lower rates, fewer loopholes, and a simpler code, said the Washington Post. But the old conservative canard that tax cuts can pay for themselves through increased economic growth remains magical. logical thinking, especially when the business cuts deprive the Treasury of more than $2.4 trillion over a decade. Experience shows that tax cuts are almost never self-financing, and Mnuchin's dishonest math would require almost unprecedented levels of GDP growth. After 8 years of mercilessly attacking President Obama for doing too little to cut the deficit, the Republicans are Republicans really going to approve a budget-busting tax cut? Trump was wise to climb down from his border wall for now, said the Chicago Tribune. Democrats were hoping his demands for immediate funding would lead to a shutdown and a widespread verdict of incompetence. Instead, the president backed away while securing funding for other much-needed improvements to border security. Indeed, that may have been his plan all along, and with illegal border crossings from Mexico already way down since his inauguration, Trump can portray this negotiation as a victory. What the columnist said, there are many unanswered questions about Trump's tax plan, particularly how it would affect the deficit, said Michael Tanner in NationalReview.com, but lower corporate tax rates should draw broad bipartisan support. They'll stimulate growth, hiring, and raising, and thus help workers far more than trade wars or minimum wage laws. Cutting taxes would be immensely popular, said Ford O'Connell in the Washington Examiner. But Trump better get the legislation through Congress by the end of the year. After that, members of Congress will start focusing on their reelection campaigns for the 2018 midterms, and little will get done. Trump craves some big wins, but his tax reform plan may suffer the same fate as the Obamacare replacement, said Ben White and Nancy Cook in Politico.com. Sources close to House Speaker Paul Ryan said Trump's unfunded trillions in cuts are a magic unicorn that will never get past the House's deficit hawks. Democrats, meanwhile, will be able to blast Trump for wanting to explode the deficit and give his own businesses and children a massive tax break. In the end, even Republicans are already quietly saying Trump's current approach to the tax issue simply won't work. Trump still has time to learn from his mistakes, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. A poll last week found that an astonishing 96% of people who voted for the president would do so again. If Trump hasn't lost his supporters after 3 months of high-profile gaffes, embarrassing blunders, and nearly constant headlines about Russian interference in the election, the tipping point may never happen. Loyal support from a critical mass of Republican voters may give the president several years to push through the major items on his agenda. The controversy of the week, not surprisingly, Trump evaluating his first 100 days. It's something of an arbitrary deadline, yes, said Amber Phillips in WashingtonPost.com. But every new president since FDR has been judged by his first 100 days in office. For Donald Trump, who reaches that milestone this week, the comparisons are not flattering. Trump is the first president since Jimmy Carter not to sign major legislation in the first 100 days, despite Republicans enjoying full control of Congress. His approval rating hovers around a dismal 40%, by far the lowest of any modern president at the 100-day mark. In a tweet last week, Trump dismissed the ridiculous standard of the first 100 days. But during the campaign, he released a contract with the American voter, setting out what he explicitly called my 100-day action plan to make America great again. The contract listed 10 pieces of legislation Trump would try to pass in his first 3 months, including funding a border wall and launching a $1 trillion infrastructure program. None of that has come to fruition. Only one major piece of legislation, Trump's disastrous attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, has even been introduced in Congress. Are we surprised to find Donald Trump in breach of contract? Asked Ron Insana at CNBC.com. He's a businessman who has overpromised and underdelivered his whole life, declaring bankruptcy 6 times, creating a faux university that defrauded students, and repeatedly refusing to pay contractors and laborers. His presidency is beginning to look like another failed effort, providing theatrics instead of substance. The president's first 100 days have been just fine, said Mark Thiessen in WashingtonPost.com. Trump's greatest achievement is probably the nomination and confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch, 49, to the Supreme Court. Every conservative 5-4 decision for the next 30 years should count as one of Trump's first 100 days accomplishments. Trump has also withdrawn from the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, restarted work on the Keystone XL pipeline, and crucially, restored our credibility on the world stage with his swift military response to the use of chemical weapons in Syria. On border security, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com, Trump's executive actions have dramatically reduced illegal immigration, with apprehensions at the Mexican border down a whopping 64% from last year. That is a solid success by any measure. Trump may not yet have done very much, said Ben Castleman in 538.com, but he's done a lot of undoing. Trump, his cabinet appointees, and congressional Republicans have been hard at work dismantling President Obama's legacy wherever they can and have delayed, suspended, or reversed dozens of Obama-era rules on banking, the environment, firearms purchases, and dozens of other issues. Trump supporters are more than happy with his performance so far, said Selena Zito in NYPost.com, with only 2% of those who voted for him saying they regret their vote. To them, the president remains disruptive, unconventional, defiant, and willing to change his mind. They'll give him time to deliver on his promises. Why are critics focusing on Trump's lack of positive achievements, asked Jeet here in NewRepublic.com. In just 100 chaotic days, he has clumsily taken major steps towards his goal of radically transforming America into an ultra-nationalist country that scorns immigrants, threatens and alienates aliens, and embraces racism and xenophobia. Given the lasting damage he's already done to America at home and abroad, Trump's first 100 days have been as consequential as those of any president in history. Time for our good week, bad week items. It was a good week for being grounded after President Trump learned while speaking to crew members aboard the International Space Station that they turn their own urine into drinking water. It's really not as bad as it sounds, astronaut Peggy Whitson told the president. Better you than me, Trump replied. It was a good week for Adam Sandler after Netflix revealed that the 3 films the comedian has made for the streaming service, which have been savagely mocked by critics, have garnered more than 500 million hours of viewing by its subscribers. And it was a good week for power couples. After a partnership led by former Florida Governor Jeb Bush and ex-Yankee Derek Jeter won a bidding auction to buy the Florida Marlins for a reported $1.3 billion. Bush is expected to be the control person or principal owner. But it was a bad week for self-reliance after a British survey found that 1 in 5 people admit they don't know how to change a light bulb or boil an egg. Researchers said there is a widening skills gap in society. It was a bad week for the C-suite after Alibaba chairman Jack Ma predicted that robots will soon replace CEOs at most major corporations because they're more rational than humans. 15 years ago, I gave speeches reminding everyone that the internet will impact all industries, Ma said, but people didn't listen because I was a nobody. And it was a bad week for Shoddy Chic after high-end retailer Nordstrom was widely ridiculed for selling $425 jeans that come caked with fake mud. The pre-distressed American workwear, Nordstrom says, will serve as proof that wearers are not afraid to get down and dirty. And before we leave the page, a boring but important note. Senate Russia probe off to a slow start. The Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian interference in the U.S. election has stalled, Yahoo News reported this week, with some Democrats accusing the panel's chairman, Richard Burr, Republican from North Carolina, of impeding progress. In March, Burr vowed to get to the bottom of Russia's involvement in the 2016 race. As the House Intelligence Committee's own probe became embroiled in partisan infighting and ethics concerns. But he has failed to sign letters requesting important evidence, said a source, and the panel has yet to issue a single subpoena or interview any high-profile witnesses. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, said things need to pick up, adding that the recent hiring of 2 new staffers should help speed the process. On the briefing page this week, the title is Policing for Profit. Law enforcement officials have seized billions from citizens through civil forfeiture. Is that process being abused? What is civil forfeiture? A controversial legal process that enables law enforcement agencies to seize cash, cars, property, and other assets from people who are merely suspected of criminal activity. The owner doesn't have to be arrested or charged. The arresting officer only needs to demonstrate probable cause that the asset is linked to criminal activity, most often drugs. Once something has been seized, the owner cannot get it back unless he or she goes to court to prove it was not a proceed of crime. The abuse of this process by local and state police and the U.S. Justice Department has sparked a growing backlash among both Democratic and libertarian-leaning Republican members of Congress, who say the process is a flagrant breach of constitutional due process rights and that it gives law enforcement agencies a powerful incentive to act unscrupulously. It's simply not right, says Southern Poverty Law Center attorney Emily Early, for the government to take and keep someone's money, vehicle, or other property without having to prove any wrongdoing by the owner. Conservative Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas recently agreed, saying the forfeiture system has led to egregious and well-chronicled abuses and should be reviewed by the High Court. When was forfeiture created? Civil forfeiture laws were crafted in the early days of our nation's founding, primarily as a tool against piracy on the high seas. They later made an extensive comeback during Prohibition, but the practice became much more widespread during the war on drugs in the 1980s, when law enforcement agencies wanted more tools to target cartel leaders and big-time dealers. The 1984 Comprehensive Crime Control Act created a special fund that transferred forfeiture proceeds to the crime-fighting agencies responsible for them. It also set up the Equitable Sharing Program, which rewards local police forces that assist federal agencies with up to 80% of forfeiture spoils. In the three decades since, civil forfeiture activity has exploded. Annual deposits into the Justice Department's fund grew from $93.7 million in 1986 to about $1 billion in 2007 and up to $4.5 billion in 2014. The Drug Enforcement Agency alone has confiscated $4 billion from drug suspects since 2007, some $3.2 billion from people who were never charged with a crime. Senator Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, has described the system as a slush fund for the federal government. What about at the state level? State and local police seized $2.5 billion in cash from nearly 62,000 people without warrants or indictments between 2001 and 2014. An investigation by the Washington Post found these agencies generally use the proceeds to pad their budget and buy new cars and other police equipment. In Texas, the money can even go straight into the officers' pockets in the form of bonuses. Not surprisingly, police departments that have become heavily reliant on forfeiture fiercely oppose any efforts to curb the practice. They argue that forfeiture rules allow law enforcement agencies to disrupt drug trafficking operations. Many cases, more than 70% in Texas, aren't contested, which police say implies guilt. Attorney General Jeff Sessions insists forfeiture is justified, saying that 95% of cases involve criminals who've done nothing in their lives but sell dope. Is that true? The evidence suggests that it's not. People often can't try to retrieve seized assets because they don't have enough money to hire a lawyer for a long, grueling battle. The value of assets being seized, moreover, indicates that many forfeiture targets are hardly major drug kingpins, and abuses of the system are well documented. In 2014, cops at Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport confiscated $11,000 from a student named Charles Clark because they said his suitcases smelled of marijuana. The cash was his life savings, and it took him 2 years to recover the money. In 2012, police wrongly confiscated $17,550 from a restaurant owner in Virginia. By the time he recovered his money, 12 months later, his business had gone bust because he lacked capital. Who's pushing back against forfeiture? In response to an outcry by civil libertarians, 13 states now require a criminal conviction in most or all forfeiture cases. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin, and more than a dozen co-sponsors from both parties recently reintroduced a bill that would shift responsibility for proving guilt or innocence from the individual to the law enforcement agency, and would increase the burden of proof to clear and convincing evidence. Brad Cates, a former Justice Department official who helped create the system in the 1980s, now says forfeiture has become unconscionable and needs to be abolished. Dick Carpenter of the Institute for Justice, a libertarian law organization, agrees. This is not something isolated happening to drug kingpins and mafiosos, he said. It is happening to everyday people in every state across the country. time for a few columns. I'll start with two from the U.S. First, the GOP's identity crisis. What does it mean to be a conservative Republican in the age of Trump? No one knows, said Josh Krasher, as President Trump's unorthodox and rapidly shifting policies have left Republicans with a serious identity crisis. That confusion was on display in recent special elections to fill a House vacancy in Georgia, where the Republican nominee, Karen Handel, ran as an orthodox conservative who kept an arm's length distance from Trump. Two Republicans who identified themselves as Trump supporters, meanwhile, performed dismally, getting less than 1% of the vote each. Most of the enthusiasm in the conservative district was for Democrat John Ossoff, who nearly got a majority of votes. Republican voters seemed to be demoralized by the party's lack of legislative accomplishments during Trump's first 100 days. Trump's constant changes of position suggest to many Republicans that he doesn't seem to know what he stands for anymore. That impression has emboldened many Republicans in Congress to distance themselves from the president. The danger is that if the GOP goes into the 2018 midterm elections divided, defensive, and with no clear message, it will give the Democrats a path to winning back control of the House. Connection can breed contempt. The global village, it turns out, is a nasty place, said Nicholas Carr. Mark Zuckerberg and the other digital zealots have long promised that bringing humanity together in a giant communications network would create a more harmonious world. But rather than triggering a planetary outbreak of peace, love, and understanding, Facebook, Twitter, and Snapchat and other internet communities have splintered the U.S. and the Western world into angry factions and filled public discourses with vitriol and insult. This actually shouldn't surprise us. Social research has found abundant evidence that the more close contact we have with other people, the more we become irritated by their different ideas, preferences, and habits. Indeed, the constant avalanche of online self-disclosure can create an oppressive sense of digital crowding. British researchers have found, making people prone to lashing out at those who overshare. The Internet's faceless mode of interaction also serves as a lure to antisocial sadists who enjoy inflicting psychic pain. More than two decades into the Internet revolution, we now know that technology is an amplifier for humanity's worst traits as well as our best. What it doesn't do is make us better people. Here's an international column, East Africa. The world looks away from a famine. People are starving to death in Africa and the Middle East, yet the world just shrugs, said Damien Roustel. The United Nations called for immediate emergency donations of $4.4 billion last month, warning that 20 million people in Somalia, Nigeria, South Sudan, and Yemen are at risk from famine, and that 1.4 million children are at imminent risk of death from severe malnutrition. The UN had raised only about one-fifth of the requested funds, mostly for Somalia. South Sudan and Yemen have received very little. Of course, money alone won't solve the country's problems. All four nations are struggling with civil war or violent insurgencies, but money is the beginning of the solution. And right now, the international public has disaster fatigue. They've spent all their sympathy on Iraq, Syria, and the migrant crisis in Europe. There's little left for Africa. In Somalia, it's a man-made crisis, said Abdel Fattah Hassan Ali. I have seen famine victims entering Mogadishu, the children's emaciated and barefoot, the mothers weeping. The river dried and the trees dried, then the goats started to die, one woman told me. Some of our family are already dead. If our country had a functioning government, it would have had a famine early warning system in place so that people at risk during a drought could get help. But since 1991, we've had nonstop conflict and no effective state institutions. We chose violence over peace, blood over brotherhood. Where is the U.S. in this crisis? Asked Edward Luce in the Financial Times. The world is facing its biggest famine in 70 years, and President Trump has said nothing. The $407 million the U.S. has contributed to the relief effort so far was allocated during the Obama administration. No new funds have been requested by Trump, who sees the world as a zero-sum game. Unless the U.S. gets something back for its foreign aid, the money is wasted. But if famine sets in, the flow of refugees from the West, from Africa, will dwarf the numbers that have been coming from Syria. Conditions will be ripe for further radicalization across Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. This cannot be in America's interests. Trump wants to slash the budget for foreign aid and diplomacy by 30% and increase the Pentagon's budget by $54 billion. Spending $1 billion of that on famine relief would achieve more on the ground in Africa for U.S. national security than a dozen new frigates. Westerners have grown cynical about aid, said Anne Burchett Albertson in HuffingtonPost.co.uk. But with enough assistance, a country can turn around. The massive Live Aid-inspired flow of relief to famine-hit Ethiopia in the 1980s helped fund the building of schools and health infrastructure. The result? Ethiopia now weathers drought with relative ease. The more we help now, the more we build resilience within these countries to stand firmly on their own. And on to the last word this week, titled The Meaning of Mount Rushmore. The monument in South Dakota was designed to inspire awe at the greatness of American democracy, said journalist Sam Anderson. Today, there's something poignant about the sculpture's self-confident grandiosity. Nothing about our trip to Mount Rushmore went according to plan. Our flight was delayed. We found ourselves stranded in the Minneapolis airport for 4 hours. Minneapolis airport, 4 hours, we typed into Google, and the internet responded by persuading us to take a train to the Mall of America. It was not just a mall, but an elaborate funhouse of malls, at the center of which was, somehow, a gigantic amusement park. I could see my kids' minds recalibrating the relative scales and possibilities of American experience. It's like Disney World, my son said, but inside a mall. They wanted to stay forever, to be swallowed by the crowds. But we were on a different pilgrimage in search of a different America. So we continued on. Late that night, finally, we reached South Dakota. It was unfathomably empty. In downtown Rapid City, we idled at empty intersections, block after snowy block, waiting for traffic lights that governed no traffic. Emptiness is, to some degree, South Dakota's natural condition. It is the 17th largest state in the country, but has only the 46th largest population, the square mileage of Senegal, the people of Fort Worth. Why were we there? Why had I dragged my family, my wife, and our Snapchatting 12-year-old daughter, and our long-haired, talkative 9-year-old son away from work and school to see, of all places, Mount Rushmore? I couldn't say exactly. All I knew was that I seemed to be suffering a crisis of scale. America was taking up a larger part of my mind than it ever had before. It was dominating my internal landscape, crowding out other thoughts, blocking my view of regular life. I couldn't tell if it was reaching its proper size, growing the way a problem tends to grow just before a solution is found, or if it was swelling the way an organ does before it fails and bursts. I felt drawn to Mount Rushmore instinctively, like a spawning fish to the head of a river. I wanted to look at American bigness squarely in the face. The Black Hills are a geological oddity, an island of rock thrusting out from an ocean of prairie. They contain some of the oldest and hardest stone in the world. Over the course of 70 million years or so, erosion has sculpted them into spindly towers and ragged loaves. 5,000-foot-high turrets protected by moats and moonscape boulders. To the Plains Indians, the area was supernaturally charged, a place of powerful spirits, sudden raging storms, magical caves, and special trees. The landscape was so rugged and remote that it managed to repel white civilization deep into the 19th century. This changed suddenly in the 1870s when the notorious George Armstrong Custer arrived to make a map of the Black Hills. In the course of exploring, Custer's men discovered gold. Word flew across the nation, and before long, a fire hose of white Americans went spraying into the isolated land, violating an Indian treaty with impunity, setting up mining towns and trading posts, blasting roads through mountains, changing the nature of the place forever. Before long, of course, the boom went bust. Many miners left, the region's economy sagged. In the 1920s, local boosters proposed an eccentric solution. What if some of the Black Hills' ancient rock could be carved into a monument to American history? Patriotic tribute that would also serve in this new era of automobiles as a roadside attraction. Only one American sculptor seemed up to the task. He was, like the sculptor he would create, a larger-than-life weirdo. John Goodson de la Mothe Borglum, son of a Danish immigrant, friend of Auguste Rodin, publicity hound, populist salesman, self-styled tough guy with a white Stetson and a flowing scarf and a dark bushy mustache. At the time, Borglum was working on another huge sculpture chiseled into the front of a mountain, a tribute in Georgia to great heroes of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson. When Borglum was enticed to visit the Black Hills, he saw presidents, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln. Anything else, he argued, would be too limited, too provincial, not sufficiently star-spangled USA. From the beginning, the project struck many locals as absurd. Controversy raged in the newspapers. To carve statues in the mountains, one wrote, would be as incongruous and ridiculous as keeping a cow in the rotunda of the Capitol building. Funding for Mount Rushmore was touching and go, as was political and public support. But Borglum would not give up. The project took far longer and cost far more money than anyone could have imagined. Logistics were murderously complex. Men were lowered over the rock face on sling chairs. Carving was done mainly with dynamite and jackhammers. At one point, a crack running through the stone threatened to break Thomas Jefferson's nose, so his face was blown off the mountain and started again in a different spot. Mount Rushmore is not just big, it is about bigness, a monument to monumentalism. Borglum was obsessed with America's size. The heroic story of a handful of tiny East Coast settlements growing to engulf an entire continent. The four presidents were chosen largely for their roles in this expansion. Jefferson, for instance, not only wrote the Declaration of Independence, but also greatly increased the country via the Louisiana Purchase. Teddy Roosevelt oversaw the creation of the Panama Canal. which increased America's global reach. The sculpting of Mount Rushmore began in 1927 with a ceremony overseen by President Calvin Coolidge, who wore a comically large hat. Work spanned 14 years, encompassing some of the defining spasms of American history, the Great Depression, the beginning of World War II. The sculpture was finished 1 month and 1 week before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Work would have continued. The plan was to depict each of the presidents down to the waist. But funding began to dry up again, and Borglum died, and after a few finishing touches, the figures were abandoned as good enough. This was precisely the moment when American influence was about to explode. The dawn of 50 years of prosperity and cultural dominance. Mount Rushmore was completed, conveniently just in time to serve as kind of a superheated mascot for the mythology of the greatest generation and the baby boomers. That America's hugeness is bound up with its nobility, that it deservedly dominates the globe. Several times, as we drove to Mount Rushmore, we worried that the road was too small for our car. We had rented a huge SUV like a tank without the gun turret, a rolling monolith of American power. And the road to Rushmore was old, narrow, and winding. The pavement was covered with a skin of snow. We chugged over it with confidence. In this way, winding and winding, switchback after switchback, we made our way up the mountain. By the time we pulled into the Mount Rushmore parking garage, after an eternity of winding, everyone was exhausted and starving. The park's restaurant was closed for renovation, so we settled into a sort of triage unit cafe next door. We ate the bad food in tense silence. After lunch, we walked outside to the viewing deck, and there was Mount Rushmore. That was really the biggest thing you could say about it. There it was. Rushmore is a ubiquitous American image, tattooed on the inside of every citizen's eyelids, so it felt disorienting to see it in three-dimensional space, pinned to this particular spot on Earth. We had the viewing deck almost to ourselves. There was Washington out front, the leader of the band, noble, aristocratic, and smooth, his mouth a grim stone line, a dollop of snow stuck to the bridge of his nose. Peering over his shoulder like a shy sidekick was Jefferson, his big nose held high, showing his nostrils to the world. This was not an artistic choice. The grain of the rock had forced Borglum to tilt the head back. Lincoln stood apart from them, heavy eyebrows frosted with snow, and in the middle, almost swallowed by the mountain, was Teddy Roosevelt, with his wire-rimmed spectacles and Freddie Mercury mustache. They were all looking in slightly different directions, not at us, but far over our heads into the great American distance. I must admit that in person, I was not especially moved by the beauty of the sculptures. They were essentially traditional busts, distinguished mainly by their insane scale and placement. The novelty of it was stronger than the beauty. What stood out most was everything around the president's faces. The Black Hills landscape that spreads and spreads, incorporating eons of old rock and new growth. This was something that was hard to appreciate in photographs, which tend to be tightly cropped. Just the president's, stony and smooth. But the mountain itself is magnificent, rough and rutted and craggy, like an ancient crocodile's back. It made the giant heads look small. I felt a rush of emotion that was not patriotic, but awe. Awe at human weirdness, at our capacity to create in the actual world such an improbable and unnecessary artifact as this. Why had humans done this? Why did Mount Rushmore exist? Oh, it's a nice little mountain thing, my son said appreciatively, and then he asked if we could leave. We drove away from Mount Rushmore down and down through the uncarved wilderness into the city of Custer, a windswept Old West outpost. Outside Custer was another granite mountain being carved, Rushmore style, into the enormous likeness of a historic figure. It depicted Crazy Horse, the enigmatic leader of the Oglala Sioux, one of the fiercest defenders of the Black Hills from the indignity of white invasion. It was a sort of corrective to Rushmore, a reclaiming of the landscape by the people from whom it was stolen. My family was tired and refused to get out of the car, so I walked through the museum myself. The carving had been in progress without federal funding for nearly 70 years. The finished figure will be 563 feet tall, sitting on his horse, pointing toward the Black Hills. And it began to seem foreign to me, our American obsession with size. We are born a fantasy of bigness. We are tall and strapping, with big hats and big hair and loud clothes and booming voices. We drive our big cars through the epic landscapes of our giant continent. We work in tall buildings where we give 110% in order to build larger-than-life careers. Our great ideas define infinite eras. Our big weapons win big wars. We are economically, geographically, culturally, and spiritually huge. The gigantic states of America. There is something childish about this fantasy, the way it tends to conflate virtue and size. Why does goodness have to be huge? It is a dangerous belief, and one that inevitably causes stress and confusion when, as it must, it runs up against reality. Inevitably, there will be a shift in scale. The dominant thing, nation, culture, religion, demographic, will begin to shrink. Does it lose its virtue with its dominance? If we truly believe that, then what virtue will we not be willing to sacrifice to make ourselves feel big again? Later, as the sun was beginning to set, we drove through Custer State Park. We passed through huge, shaggy herds of buffalo, which raised their heads and stared. The landscape seemed to change every 500 feet. Lakes, buttes, forest, gushes of red dirt. A small herd of pronghorns glided over a bluff, ghostly white on the snow. It was as beautiful as any land I've ever seen. Driving through it inspired the kind of awe that the sculptures of Rushmore had not. But then again, we never would have seen this landscape if we hadn't come to look at Rushmore. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. On the health and science page, a couple of articles for you here. Climate change reroutes a river. For the first time in recorded history, human-induced climate change has altered the course of an entire river, transforming the geological landscape in a matter of days. The immense Slims River in Canada's Yukon carried meltwater northward from Kakawoosh Glacier into the Bering Sea for hundreds of years. But intense melting from unusually warm temperatures last spring caused the glacier to retreat. The melting water then carved a new channel through the ice, a new study reveals, redirecting the flow south to the Pacific Ocean via the Alsek River. The once raging Slims River Basin is now almost dry. Sheep graze on vegetation in the drained riverbed, and that change is probably permanent. Essentially, one river has captured and diverted the flow of another, a well-documented process known as river piracy. The phenomenon normally takes thousands of years, but events in the Yukon unfolded in less than a week. The researchers have little doubt human greenhouse gas emissions are responsible for Slim's change of course. The river is essentially shut off in 4 days, but it was caused by a century's worth of warming, lead author Daniel Sugar tells Scientific American. This particular event took place in a largely deserted wilderness, but climate scientists warn that as the planet warms, other drastic changes could rapidly alter water supplies, coastal flooding, ecosystems, and other factors affecting human populations. Why shoelaces untie. At long last, researchers have unraveled one of the world's most enduring enigmas. Why do shoelaces come untied? Mechanical engineers at the University of California, Berkeley put themselves through more than 100 hours of tests, running on treadmills, trudging through hallways, and swinging their legs from tables. They found that the knot's undoing is a twofold process, reports ChristianScienceMonitor.com. The impact of a shoe on the ground gradually loosens the knot. Then, swinging the legs whips the ends of the laces, causing them to slip and quickly come apart. The researchers calculated the G-force that acts on a shoelace knot is greater than the force produced by the world's most powerful roller coaster. These findings could have significant implications far beyond Adidas and Nike's. Surgical techniques, aerospace engineer, and other complex applications. When you talk about knotted structures, said lead author Christopher Daly Diamond, if you can start to understand the shoelace, then you can apply it to other things like DNA or microstructures that fail under dynamic forces. We're on the Talking Points page. O'Reilly, why the king of cable news was dethroned. Just a month ago, Bill O'Reilly was sitting pretty, said Alex Wagner in TheAtlantic.com. His Fox News show, The O'Reilly Factor, was a conservative juggernaut, raking in hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue each year. With 4 million viewers a night, O'Reilly was the undisputed king of cable news. But last week, the king was summarily ousted from his throne. Fox News announced it was dropping its biggest star in the wake of a bombshell New York Times story that revealed O'Reilly, 67, and his employers paid out $13 million to five women who claimed the TV host sexually harassed them or verbally abused them between 2002 and 2016. On screen, O'Reilly was abrasive and arrogant, said Lily Loughborough in TheWeek.com. A browbeating Irish Catholic who preached family values while launching sneering rants about liberal snowflakes and berating rape victims for wearing miniskirts. Off screen, the real man turned out to be quite a bit worse. Female colleagues accused O'Reilly of subjecting them to masturbatory phone calls and high-pressure demands for sex. When Juliet Huddy, a frequent guest on his show, spurned his advances, O'Reilly set out to professionally sabotage her and warned his former producer that if she complained, she'd wish she'd never been born. O'Reilly claimed he was victim of a smear campaign, but when more than 80 companies pulled their ads from his show, Fox's ruling Murdoch clan decided enough was enough. The media giant was out. This is truly the end of an era, said Jim Rutenberg in the New York Times. O'Reilly's stunning downfall came just 9 months after Fox's founding chairman, Roger Ailes, was also forced out amid his own harassment scandal. Together, no two people did more to build Fox News Channel into a powerful cultural political force. Ailes wanted to build a cable news empire that would speak for the angry, forgotten Americans in conservative flyover country. O'Reilly, with his Long Island working-class background and perfectly perched chip on his shoulder, was the ideal pick. His resentful rants against political correctness in the mainstream media and rage-filled warnings that white Christian America was under siege transformed Fox News into the beating heart of a new populist conservative movement, reshaping the GOP as it did so. That rising conservative populism eventually gave birth to a candidate named Donald Trump, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com, a fire-breathing American first populist who not only wasn't afraid of poking liberal elites in the eye, but reveled in it. Born 3 years apart in New York City, Trump and O'Reilly had a special connection. But while his friend has risen to the nation's highest office, O'Reilly has fallen from grace. Liberals have wanted O'Reilly's scalp for years, said Ed Rogers in the Washington Post. That's because he was an intellectual giant who exposed the abuses of liberals better than anyone else. So while liberal hypocrites excused or ignored the serial sexual abuses of Bill Clinton, they seized on unproven allegations to hound O'Reilly and Ailes out of their jobs. Fox News will never be the same, and America and the conservative cause are weaker as a result. Sorry, but this is what happens when conservatives elevate toxic celebrities as our ideological gladiators, said David French in NationalReview.com. Time and time again, we've rallied behind arrogant, self-serving men with dubious standards of morality, valuing their combativeness over anything else. Out of tribal loyalty, conservatives defended O'Reilly even in the face of multiple credible sexual harassment allegations, just as we've defended Milo Yiannopoulos and other amoral characters. The cost has been a loss of integrity. It's time for conservatives to find some real heroes who embody conservative values in both public and private and aren't milking our movement for money, power, and sex. The bosses at Fox shouldn't be given an easy ride either, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. The network has known since at least 2002 of O'Reilly's, what shall we call them, appalling ways around the newsroom. It was only when advertisers fled that the sons of Rupert Murdoch, CEO of parent company 21st Century Fox, pushed for O'Reilly to be fired. As for O'Reilly himself, while coverage of his ouster reads like a giant Irish wake, he's not dead yet. His ardent fans don't care about sexual harassment charges. Hell, many don't care about sexual harassment, period. They'll follow O'Reilly wherever he chooses to go, such as the conservative Sinclair broadcasting chain. Mark my words, liberals, you'll have Bill O'Reilly to kick around for a long time. And not much time left, so we'll just finish up with a quote. This is from Anton Chekhov, quoted in the New York Times. He says, "At the door of every contented happy man, somebody should stand with a little hammer, constantly tapping, to remind him that unhappy people exist." Well, we have run out of time again for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleradingservice.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.